This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
All right, we are wrapping up this economic year and taking some bets on where we're headed in 2017. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In New York, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, December 30th, our last show of 2016, and it's good to have you with us. We are starting off the way we do most Fridays, with a look at the week that was, the year that was, and the year to come. Joining me in our New York studio for the weekly wrap are Lynette Lopez of Business Insider and John Carney from the Wall Street Journal. Welcome, guys.
Hi, Liz.
Hey, Lizzie.
All right, we are wrapping up this year, so characterize for me 2016 in economics. Lynette, hit it.
2016 was pretty boring. I mean, you know, we had steady, slow growth. The Fed did exactly what we thought it was going to do, and nothing crashed. So, you know, boring might be a good thing, but that's what it was. It was boring.
I would say that it was a relatively boring year, except the markets did things that people predicted would the opposite would happen. We had a post-Brexit boom in England, and the stock market went bananas after Donald Trump got elected, despite all the predictions that we would see a crash. So I think there was some pretty interesting stuff going on.
Okay, so we're going to make some predictions now, or I'm going to make you make them. What do you see in the year ahead, Lynette?
Okay, so one serious prediction. I think that as 2017 rolls on, we're going to find that Donald Trump's infrastructure plan seems farther and farther away, more elusive. A semi-serious prediction, Elon Musk will start another company. A not-so-serious prediction, Donald Trump will personally attend Saturday Night Live and hate tweet from the audience.
I mean, he's already hosted it, so
yeah,
you know, he could go as a guest.
He can't take it anymore.
All right, John, what do you think? You have serious, you have funny, what do you got?
It depends, I guess, on your point of view whether this is serious or funny. I think we're going to have an economic boom. I think what we've seen in the markets will be reflected in consumer and investing activity all through 2017. The election of Donald Trump has awakened people's animal spirits. I also think that maybe the infrastructure plan in most of America won't happen, but I think we're going to build a wall. I think Donald
Trump.
You
really think that's going to happen?
I think Donald Trump is going to announce shortly after the inauguration that he is going down to cut the ribbon on the wall building ceremony.
Oh, he wants it. He wants that ribbon.
It is going
to
happen.
And what's speaking with infrastructure experts, all they could come together to agree on was that Donald Trump would want to put his name on something huge.
And
huge.
We'll have the Trump Mexican American Freedom and Friendship Wall. And that's what we'll build.
Good Lord.
John, I don't know if I should ask you for a serious or funny prediction next. But...
Well, I'll just to play off of Lynette's prediction. Elon Musk's new company should be building solar panels all across that wall. And then we can power America with Elon Musk's technology right along the border.
Lest we not forget that his solar company is a residential solar company. But hey, it's Elon. He can do whatever he wants, I guess.
I would point out that the market for solar is actually booming. And, you know, we are suddenly in a place where it's cheap and it makes sense.
But Rex Tillerson will hate solar.
That's an interesting point. So do we then see a fossil fuel boom in the next year?
Who knows?
Maybe we sell all of that solar power to Mexico. Mm. Mexico pays for the solar power from the wall and hence has paid for the wall.
Right. No, that's too smart.
That, I think, is what Al Gore would have called fuzzy math, if you can remember back that far. We've got about a minute left. I guess I'm wondering, are there shocks to the economy that we don't see out there? I realize I'm asking you to look for something unknown.
Oh, the unknown. you know, one thing that we didn't expect to happen last year at the start of the year was for Chinese markets to really start to show that they could impact the world.
Yeah.
And I think that we'll have more of that. People are predicting that 2017 will be a quiet year in China because there are a lot of political there's a lot of political gaming going on. There's a big conference, positions to be filled. So people are saying it's going to be a quiet year, but maybe we'll get a slap in the face from China. The corporate sector is looking shaky.
I think a lot of people are predicting great things for banks. They're the second, the financials are the second best performing sector in 2016. They were one of the worst.
Yeah.
They're, you know, the KBW Bank Index is up 23% since the election. I think there could be a big shock to people realizing banks aren't going to do as well as they think. And that they're a big part of most of the indexes, so they could pull down the market pretty strong if they start to disappoint investors.
But deregulation.
If it happens.
All right. Thank you both of you, Lynette Lopez from Business Insider, John Carney from The Wall Street Journal. Thanks as always.
Happy New Year.
Thank you.
On Wall Street today, a little more red. Details when we do the numbers. President-elect Donald Trump has been quite skeptical about climate change and its causes, but around the world, there's still a fair bit of momentum to cut emissions. On Monday, the Canadian province of Ontario opens the newest so-called cap-and-trade market for greenhouse gas emissions, and it'll hook up with similar carbon markets in North America. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong has the story.
Here's a rationale for a cap-and-trade market. Climate change has a cost: higher food prices, higher insurance premiums, so the emitters should pay. In Ontario, companies whose emissions are too high will have to buy credits to pollute more. They can buy them from low-carbon companies not just in Ontario, but also in Quebec and California. Michael Girard teaches climate change law at Columbia.
You've got a broader pool of emitters from whom you can find the companies that can reduce their emissions at the lowest cost. So it's the most economically efficient.
He says cap-and-trade markets are growing in the northeastern U.S., in Europe, in China, Japan, and Korea. The upshot is that companies are getting used to this, says climate policy scholar Andrew Light of the World Resources Institute and George Mason University.
Individual businesses are adapting and assuming an internal price on carbon in order to do their long-term planning. They think that this is eventually going to come, that you can't continue to pollute for free.
Into this environment comes the next president, who has vowed to undo U.S. climate rules. It all suggests a clash of forces, a maturing low-carbon economy against what's called the free rider effect. If America walks away, other countries might too.
People who are inclined already to not want to tackle this problem are going to look at any moves by the Trump administration and use as an excuse to back away.
He doubts the Trump administration can dramatically undo climate markets and policies, but it could slow things down. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Tomorrow night, millions of people all around the world will be doing the same thing, counting down to the new year with at least one eye on the TV, watching the ball drop in Times Square. ABC, NBC, and CNN are all airing New Year's Eve specials, and they're not the only ones. Think of it as the last TV battle of the year for eyeballs and ad dollars. Marketplace's Marielle Segarra reports.
Back in the day, there used to be one guy everybody watched on New Year's Eve.
Hi, this is Dick Clark with New Year's Rockin' Eve.
Coming to you. It's still rocking, only now with Ryan Seacrest.
There are about a million people packed into 18 city blocks.
But there is some competition. Carson Daly on NBC, Anderson Cooper and Kathy Griffin on CNN, and Pitbull broadcasting for Fox from Miami. If you can call it competition, that is. ABC's Rockin' Eve dwarfs the other shows, bringing in 22 million viewers on average last year. That's more than NBC and Fox combined. Syracuse University professor Robert Thompson says the other networks are playing the long game, hoping to dethrone ABC.
Everybody would like their person, their program, to be the one that takes over for another generation.
If that doesn't happen for a while, there's still a lot of money to be made.
Advertisers will pay a premium for any kind of live viewing.
Larry Gerbrandt from Media Valuation Partners says that's especially true as more people stream ad-free shows on Netflix and other platforms. Advertisers particularly want young people, the audience Pitbull's targeting. Greg Portell is a partner at A.T. Kearney.
The evidence suggests that the Pitbull show in particular is bringing in a new segment of viewers.
Portell is one of them.
If you're going to have a party and you're going to have some fun, then let's have a party. And Pitbull throws a pretty good party.
In New York, I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Most students are still on winter break and not thinking about school. For just about everyone else in education, now is the time to prepare for the new year, and there could be some big changes coming in 2017. The president-elect has signaled he'd like to shake things up, though we don't have many details yet. So from our education desk at WYPR, Marketplace senior correspondent Amy Scott joins me for a look at the big education story she'll be watching. Hi, Amy.
Hi.
You follow, you know, both K-12 and higher education, and as we look into the new year, what are some of the things that you've been watching that are sort of still on your radar screen?
I think one of the big things that we'll be watching is the Every Student Succeeds Act, which Congress passed actually at the end of last year, and it replaced the federal education law, No Child Left Behind, that had been in place for more than a decade. So this year, there's going to be a lot of work to implement that law. And one of the things it does is give states more power to decide how they hold schools accountable. States have to come up with at least one non-academic indicator, so things like access to advanced coursework, attendance, school climate. And the idea is that it's supposed to be a more fair measure of whether schools are doing a good job.
Well, we also have seen sort of a backlash against charter schools. The NAACP called for a moratorium on charters this fall. And this sort of also dovetails with the incoming administration. So what is going on sort of around charters?
Yeah, they've been in the news a lot more than usual. Charter schools have been around for decades. They're publicly funded schools that are privately managed, sometimes by for-profit companies. And the NAACP, as well as some groups connected to the Black Lives Matter movement, have basically called for a sort of pause. And their critique is that charter schools have harmed Black communities by draining resources from traditional neighborhood schools. Advocates of charter schools say they often give families an option for a better school than they might have in their neighborhood. And so I think that's going to be an interesting story to watch, particularly because the incoming Secretary of Education, or at least the nominee, Betsy DeVos, is an advocate of charter schools. So we may see the schools expand even more.
So DeVos will be the Trump administration's nominee. What else do we know about their education priorities?
Well, he didn't give a lot of details on the campaign trail. You know, education barely came up. But we do have some hints. And here is some sound of him speaking at one of his thank you rallies he's been doing in Michigan earlier this month.
Our reform plan includes eliminating Common Core, bringing education local, and providing school choice.
So it's not clear how Trump would eliminate the Common Core. States would have to do that, and actually many have, or at least they've changed the name and made some changes to the standards. But it's clear from his comments here and from his choice of Betsy DeVos that school choice is going to be a big priority. During the campaign, Trump proposed a $20 billion program that would give grants to states that would then allow low-income students to use the money to attend the school of their family's choice, including private and religious schools. So basically a voucher program.
Well, we've been talking about K-12, but you and I have both done a ton of reporting on higher education student debt, which was a big topic in the Democratic presidential primaries. Where is it now?
Yeah, remember free college? We were talking
right.
a lot about that idea during the election. That idea, at least on a federal scale, seems to be off the table with this result. But I think we may still see some efforts to rein in costs and to help students with debt. But many are expecting some of the Obama administration's regulations targeting for-profit colleges to get scaled back. But others that I've talked to say we're not going to go back to the bad old days of this aggressive recruiting and enrolling students who weren't prepared to succeed because the market has just changed. There are just fewer people enrolling in college, period, and especially at for-profit colleges, and partly because of that crackdown.
Marketplace's senior correspondent Amy Scott from the Education Desk at WIPR. Thank you, Amy.
Thank you.
Coming up.
They ask you, show me the money, right? It was a pretty hard sell.
Would you believe he's talking about a digital camera? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 57 points, 0.3%, to close at 19,762. The NASDAQ was down 48 points, 0.9%, to finish at 5383. And the S&P 500 sagged 10 points, 0.4%, to end at 2238. For the week, the Dow lost 0.8%, the NASDAQ fell 1.5%, and the S&P 500 declined 1.1%. And this is the last trading day of 2016. We note that for the year, the markets gained overall. The Dow up 13.4%, the NASDAQ climbed 7.5%, and the S&P boosted 9.5%. With President Obama's decision to expel Russian diplomats and shut down some of their luxury compounds, a look at some Russian companies. Oil giant Rosneft, whose CEO is a close associate of Putin's, pumped up 1%. Oil producer Lukoil increased 0.7%. And the natural gas company Gazprom rose 1.25%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.44%. You're listening to Marketplace.
We may not know what next year is going to bring, but your listener support of Marketplace guarantees we'll all be better informed and better prepared. Make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Help us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at Marketplace.org by December 31st.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. How many pictures do you think you took over the holidays or will take on New Year's Eve? Smartphones and digital cameras have made us all photographers. They're basically routine now. But there was a time when the whole concept of digital cameras wasn't just weird, strange, and futuristic. It threatened to upend an entire industry. Here's the latest installment in our series, Holidays, brought to you by
Imagination.
Wonderful products.
Brought to you by...
My name is Steve Sasson, and I've worked for Eastman Kodak Company for over 35 years. I began in July of 1973. I was a junior engineer. My supervisor said, we've got a filler job for you. There's a new type of imaging device called a charge coupled device imager. We want somebody to look at one of these and see if we can do anything useful with it. Our conversation probably lasted about 30 seconds, maybe. You know, it was nothing. The device itself is a small piece of silicon that you expose with light, and whatever sort of image or light pattern is imaged on that surface creates a corresponding charge pattern.
figured, well, if I'm going to measure how this thing does something, I sort of have to look at the output. And the best way to look at the output is to sort of capture each pixel and turn it into a number, digitize it. So then I started thinking, well, okay, really what I'm doing is capturing an image. So I was building a camera. Most of the parts I used to build it were I stole from around the factory. I couldn't go out and buy anything, you know. Digital voltmeter chips, digital tape cassette prototype box. Sort of looks like an Erector set with a blue box on top of it with a lens stuck on the bottom. And I would output to a television set. That we took our first full images in December of 1975. I folded the camera up and I walked down the hallway and there was a young lab technician sitting at a teletype. Her name was Joy. So I asked her, I said, could I take a snapshot of you? She said, sure, you know, whatever. The tape started to move, so that's how I knew I captured a picture. I popped it out of the tape player, put it into the playback system. It was quite a moment. Could this crazy thing actually work? Up popped the image. We could see her black hair and a white background, but her face was complete static, completely unrecognizable. Jim and I were overjoyed at what we saw because we knew so many reasons why you might not see anything at all. Well, Joy had followed us in. She looked at the picture and she said, needs work. We rewired it. It was easier to rewire it than to reprogram it, believe me. And up popped the first picture ever taken. Oh, it works. We filed for a patent, and the first patent for a digital camera was granted in 1978. U.S. Patent 5016107. We started to show it to people at Kodak, and then it became more interesting. I thought they'd spend all their time asking me, how did I get this to work? They didn't ask me any of the hows, they asked me why. Why would anybody want to do this? Very few people ever managed to successfully commercialize photographic film. Very difficult stuff to make. And once you've made that investment, the profit was considerable. So they ask you, show me the money, right? It was a pretty hard sell. I wrote a technical report largely describing the technology that went into it and how it worked. But because of all of the challenges I got for the many meetings throughout 1976, I did write a paragraph in there about where I think this is going to go. It's called The Camera of the Future. The camera described in this report represents a first attempt at demonstrating a photographic system which may, with improvements in technology, substantially impact the way pictures will be taken in the future. The picture, existing in electronic form, could be sent over conventional communication channels with little or no modification. I was not allowed to say anything publicly about any of this work for 25 years. I kept the camera, and as I moved from office to office throughout my career, sometimes I'd forget it, and so I put, please return to Steve Sasson on a poster on the back of it. Now the camera's in the Smithsonian. If you look on the back, you'll see that little sticker.
Kodak was so worried digital technology would destroy its film business, it sat on Sasson's invention far too long, and that ultimately did destroy the company. Sasson never got rich off his work, but he didn't go unrewarded. In 2010, President Obama gave him the National Medal of Science, Technology, and Innovation. I can remember the last time I used a typewriter. It was in 1994, carefully pecking out college applications. But as computers have spread throughout the world, the typewriter has almost disappeared. In Myanmar, however, many people still rely on typewriters to make a living. But even there, change is coming. The BBC's Ali Fowle has this story.
Typewriters may be a thing of the past in most of the world, but in Myanmar, they're still very much in demand. 68-year-old Uar Myint crouches over a small table in a patch of shade, typing up legal documents for the law offices nearby. He says that after years of censorship and suspicion, customers still see typewriters as more reliable and trustworthy than computers.
The advantage of typewriters is that it's easier to fill in official forms. For example, a power of attorney form can't be retyped on a computer because the form is already formatted.
Many official documents in Myanmar are still filled in by typewriters. But since transition to civilian rule 6 years ago, Myanmar has begun to advance. And as change creeps in, typewriter use is in decline. As there are no new typewriters being made for Myanmar, those who still use them have to rely on a declining number of typewriter repairmen, like Utun Bang.
A typewriter is easier to use than a computer. It's easier to carry around. Computers need accessories and electricity to work. A typewriter can be used with the light of a candle. You can use a typewriter in the jungle. That's why typewriters are better than computers.
Utun Bang has been working as a typewriter mechanic for over 50 years. He sits on a concrete floor in a rundown colonial building on Yangon's 41st Street, surrounded by dozens of typewriters, tinkering away at them with small metal tools.
In the 1960s, we would have to fix at least 10 to 15 machines a day. At the moment, I only have one or two customers, and that's in 1 month, not every day, every month.
Utun Bang learnt his trade from his father, and he still sees great value in his dying profession, which he worries may be lost with his generation.
With computers being used more and more, people will become less interested in typewriters, so I think in future they might become obsolete. I love the typewriter business a lot, and I will do this till I die.
For many people, where computers are commonplace, typewriters have become no more than ornamental pieces of nostalgia decorating hipster cafes. But in Myanmar, their practical legacy is still fresh. And although their numbers may be dwindling, those who rely on them aren't quite ready to give up just yet.
That's the BBC's Ali Fowl in Myanmar. This final note before we go today, and here is my requisite song reference. It's tricky. It's tricky. 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 It's tricky, or is about to be, for Amazon, Walmart, and Jet. They're being sued by Run DMC for alleged trademark infringement to the tune of $50 million. The group claims the companies are advertising, selling, manufacturing, promoting, and distributing multiple products using Run DMC's trademarked name and logo without permission. We're talking things like hats, t-shirts, wallets, and glasses. No comment yet from the companies. And I tried to work a Christmas and Hollis thing into this and failed. Sorry. That's our show for today. The Dow dropped 57 points, 0.3%. The NASDAQ was down 48 points, 0.9%. And the S&P 500 sagged 10 points, 0.4%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. This week, Marketplace is produced by Betsy Streisand. Sitara Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president. And today, we say goodbye to George Judson, a member of our senior editing staff for nearly a decade. Happy retirement, George. We will miss you. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. We'll see you all on Monday. Happy New Year. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.